And let's get started with your latest article on the consortium news. The title is On a Highway to Hell. And could you elaborate on this article for us? It's so important, in my opinion.
Well, basically, the article expands on a New York Times reporting by David Sanger that the Biden administration in March of this year signed off on what's known as the President's Nuclear Employment Guidance. It's a document not too many Americans are familiar with. Many Americans are familiar with the Nuclear Posture Review. It's a much more publicly discussed document. And the Biden administration published its Nuclear Posture Review in 2022. The Nuclear Employment Guidance is generally only issued when there's been a change of significance in the Nuclear Posture Review or in circumstances that requires America to rethink its nuclear war planning. Employment means how we use our nuclear weapons. Now, this is just guidance. Once this has been reported to Congress, the guidance is sent to the Secretary of Defense, who then puts forward the Secretary of Defense the nuclear employment guidance, which is the plan. He's telling the warfighters, this is how we will use our nuclear weapons when called upon to do so. As you can imagine, this is an extraordinarily sensitive document. According to the New York Times, no electronic copies exist. There's only a handful of hard copies, and they're very tightly controlled. What's important about this is to, again, put it into context. Right now, the United States is capped to the number of nuclear weapons we can deploy by the New START Treaty. That's a bilateral treaty between the United States and Russia. The treaty was written when, in 2010, the continuation of treaties that went back to 1991, the original START Treaty. When the United States and then the Soviet Union and later Russia had a near monopoly on strategic nuclear weapons in the tens of thousands. We've since then reduced them. I think the Russians have around 6,000 warheads in their arsenal. We have a little over 5,000, but the treaty says you can only have 1,550 deployed warheads. That is warheads that are ready to be used in a time of war. So the nuclear employment guidance and the nuclear employment plan that the United States has to go to war in nuclear weapons makes use of these deployed weapons. That means that each weapon doesn't exist just to exist. It exists because there's a target out there waiting for it to hit in time of war, accordance to whatever scenario presents itself. That is the war plan. Right now, the vast majority of these weapons are earmarked for a war with Russia. Why? Well, because the primary purpose of these weapons is deterrence. And a key aspect of deterrence is that if Russia were to use nuclear weapons against us, we must convince the Russians that our retaliation would be so terrible that the consequences would far outweigh any perceived benefits Russia might get from using nuclear weapons, therefore the deterrence. So it's not just to say if you nuke us, we'll nuke you, but to actually have the real capability to strike back and bring harm. We, of course, have reserved nuclear weapons for other contingencies. I mean, we can speculate on what those might be. An Iranian contingency where if we were, for instance, to take out the Firdos nuclear enrichment plant, it's underground. Conventional bunker busters won't work. We'll probably need to use one of the newly modified B-61 gravity bombs that'll come in, or maybe something else. North Korea, I'm sure, has a nuclear employment plan attached to it. So does China. Perhaps India, perhaps Pakistan in the case of an emergency. Who knows? We might even have a war plan against Israel. We plan for everything. But the number of warheads allocated to these contingencies previously has been minimal. But what's happened since the Biden administration came into power is we've been provoking China over the issue of Taiwan, over the South China Sea. And as a result, we now have to consider the real possibility, some would even say probability, of a full-scale war with China. Now, from the Chinese perspective, because they have to consider the same thing, they have to take into account that they may have conventional either parity or supremacy, superiority in a fight, meaning they'll win a stand-up conventional fight against the United States, which then could prompt the United States to go nuclear. And if the United States is going to go nuclear, one of the things the United States may seek to do is preempt China's ability to strike back at the United States. China currently has a force of a couple hundred strategic nuclear warheads assigned to liquid fuel missiles. The warheads are detached. The missiles are there, but they'd have to be fueled. By the time we detected them fueling, we could strike them, take them out, and China no longer has a nuclear deterrent. So what the Chinese have done is they've sought to modernize and expand their strategic nuclear capabilities. They've built around 360 missile silos spread out in the deserts of Western China. And in those silos, they're deploying what's known as a DF-41. It's a solid rocket. That means it fires instantly. There's no refuel. There's no fueling time. With 10 multiple warheads, independently targetable warheads. That means that each missile that takes off can hit 10 targets. And if you have 100 of those missiles, you can hit 1,000 targets. Now China's in a place to compete as a peer against the United States. But here's the problem. We have a war plan for Russia to take out about 1,500 Russian warheads. We now have to factor in the potential between 1,000 and 1,500 Chinese warheads. We don't have sufficient forces to do that, especially if we're allocating everything to Russia. So a new nuclear employment plan has to be put in place. And this plan includes not just how we plan on using, where we allocate these warheads, because trust me, a significant number are going to have to be reallocated from Russia to China. That means we have less warheads to deal with the Russian problem. Now, in the past, we may have over-targeted a Russian system, saying that we're going to fire, you know, 3-4 missiles at it to take it out. Now we have to go in with fewer, less redundancy. And in that case, we might have to change the operational parameters, meaning rather than wait into a tit-for-tat exchange, preemption may have to become part of our strategy. We may have to be forward-leaning, that if we plan on using nuclear weapons against Russia, we may have to preempt a Russian response so that we can take out more of their weapons up front, and not have to worry about holding back weapons for a second strike or something of that nature. So now we go to China. And again, our policy towards China will probably be preemption because we have not enough weapons. The point is, this nuclear employment plan makes the possibility of nuclear war greater, not less. It embraces or leans towards a doctrine of nuclear preemption. That is, if we feel the adversary is getting ready to do something, rather than wait for it to happen, we're going to preempt it because we don't have sufficient warheads, which means also now that the New START Treaty, which expires in February 2026, there's not a snowball's chance in hell it's going to be kept alive. Why? Because we need more warheads. So we're going to let that treaty lapse. And we've already been told by the Biden administration that they plan on increasing the number of warheads without limitation, meaning that the cap will be what we deem necessary to fight nuclear war on multiple fronts. This triggers an arms race because China and Russia are going to be looking at that too, and they're going to respond in kind. And so now we're going to be increasing the nuclear arsenals on all parties while the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons has been lowered precipitously. Russia has just announced that it has rethought its nuclear doctrine. Previously, their doctrine was premised on if you attack us with nukes, we respond. Or if you attack us with a combination of non-nuclear and nuclear power, or just non-nuclear, that threatens the existential survival of Russia, we respond. But because the United States has changed the game using Ukraine as a proxy of the West to carry out strategic strikes inside Russia, the Russians have now had to say, how do we deter that? And you deter that by lowering the threshold even further and talk about preemption. So I think the Russians have probably adopted their own policy of nuclear preemption, which means that if they feel that the collective West, either directly or indirectly through a proxy, is ready to carry out strategic deep strikes into Russia that threaten command and control, strategic communications, nuclear, that the Russians will preempt that, either non-nuclear or nuclear. Wow, there we are on the threshold of thermonuclear war as we speak. This is happening right now. That's why I call it a highway to hell, because there's no off-ramp. There's literally no off-ramp. We're no one's talking arms control. There is no discussion of disarmament. There is no discussion of getting the New START Treaty back alive. There is no discussion of entering arms control discussions with the Chinese. Nothing. All we're talking about is an arms race. And here's the thing. Deterrence strategy, we've survived since World War II. Nobody's used a nuclear weapon because of nuclear deterrence. It's still a dangerous strategy, but the concept is I won't use them if you don't use them. But what we've gone with this new nuclear employment plan is from deterrence to war fighting. And the second you move away from deterrence and accept nuclear weapons as a component of your war fighting plans, that means that somewhere out there, there's a scenario where you're going to use nuclear weapons preemptively. And given the tensions that exist in the world today, it's just a matter of time till that scenario manifests itself and we find ourselves in a full-scale nuclear war.
Do you consider any role for the European Union right now? Are they talking with the United States considering these new strategies on the part of the United States, and how dangerous is that for their survival in that region between Russia and the United States and even with China?
I don't think we're having this kind of discussion with the European Union. These are discussions that take place within the framework of NATO. NATO, you know, one could say is the military arm of the European Union, but it's a standalone defensive alliance, military alliance that has a nuclear component. NATO has its own NATO nuclear deterrence in the form of 100 or so American B-61 gravity bombs that we've deployed around five bases throughout Europe, including Turkey. And one of the things that NATO has discussed is taking around 20% of these weapons and putting them on full operational status so that they're not locked up in a storage igloo, you know, safed off, can't be used. They're out, ready to be loaded onto a plane, you know, the safety's removed and deployed on a moment's notice. Again, lowering the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons. NATO seems to be satisfied with the American response. NATO wants to ensure that if Russia threatens it with nuclear weapons, that the United States is all in. One of NATO's biggest fears is that the United States would seek to have a nuclear conflict limited to Europe only and just sit back and let Europe burn. Europe feels safe if they say the United States is going to burn with us, because the United States might not act precipitously and other nations might take it seriously and not seek to provoke, other nations being Russia. But you know, Germany has just agreed to allow intermediate range missiles back on its soil. These missiles were eliminated by the INF Treaty. The last ones were pulled out of service and destroyed in 1991. We've had decades now without these destabilizing weapons in play. Now we're going to put them back. Again, what I talked about, if Russia has a forward-leaning doctrine of preemption and we have a doctrine of preemption, now we deploy intermediate range missiles. Remember, the Russians talk about, you know, a range of threats, nuclear and non-nuclear, to their command and control, etc. If you have the Dark Eagle hypersonic missile, even if it doesn't have a nuclear warhead, deployed in Germany, in 7 minutes after launch, it can hit Moscow, taking out Russian leadership. That's the same as a nuclear threat. And if Russia detects that those missiles are getting ready to launch, Russia will preempt with nuclear weapons. This is an extraordinarily destabilizing move, and NATO seems to be okay with it. One would like to believe that the German people would reenact what their forefathers did back in 1981 and take to the streets. 400,000 went to Bonn in 1981. Hundreds of thousands took to the streets in 1982, helping lead to the fall of the government of Helmut Schmidt in 1983. Over a million Germans went to the street, putting pressure on the Germans, who then acceded or agreed to the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Even though it was a bilateral treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union, there was a component in there where Germany agreed to get rid of its Pershing 1 missiles as part of this treaty, recognizing the inherent destabilizing impact that these weapons had. This was brought about because the German people said, no, nein, we don't want this. So it'd be nice if the German people could replay that history and go to the streets and say, no, we don't want the Dark Eagle on our soil. And maybe that could begin a process of reevaluation by Germany, by NATO, by Russia, by the United States about the dangerous escalatory measures that have been taken, and find a way through diplomacy, arms control discussions to pull back and bring these weapons under control. We don't need or want an arms race. We can't afford it, and the consequences will be fatal.
When it comes to Germany right now, with the rise of the AfD alternative for Deutschland right now, and we have learned that a far left candidate in Germany as well is against the conflict in Ukraine, against sending more weapons to Ukraine. They don't consider this policy as beneficial for their country. But do you think they're going to change their policy, that they may decide that we don't need these missiles on the German soil?
Well, right now, we can't rely on either the alternative for Deutschland or this new Sarah, I can't pronounce her last name, I apologize to her. But basically, she's a noted left-wing politician who broke away from the left party this year to run because she doesn't agree with their policies. So we have sort of the far left and the far right both saying that, support for the war in Ukraine is wrong, that Germany would be better off with better relations with Russia. And they're both anti-immigration and they're both Eurosceptic. So, but the thing is, when you bring them together, I think, they just had regional elections in Saxony and Thuringia, two Eastern states in Germany, part of the former East Europe, where there's a lot of resentment to the West about unification, how it's happened. The economy's not clicking the way it wants, and they don't view Russia the same way that the propagandized Western part of Germany does. So, for instance, in Thuringia, the alternative for Deutschland, AfD, came in first place. They won. They won the most votes. In Saxony, they came in a close second place. The ruling coalition collapsed. The three parties that are in it, the Greens, the leftists, and the Christian Democrats, I think, they're down. They're sort of out of play. But the problem is there's not that it was the Social Democrats. The Christian Democrats are the lead opposition. They actually won in Saxony and came in second in Thuringia. Now, one would think that and then the Sarah Wagenknecht party, they came in third in both Saxony and Thuringia, doing quite well. If the problem is that there's probably going to be a coalition formed between the Christian Democrats and the other parties that aren't the alternative for Deutschland and the Sarah Wagenknecht party, that will be able to come up with a governing majority. So they'll keep these two parties out of power, even though together they're the dominant, they're dominant power. That might work this year, but Germany's collapsing politically right now. There's this great discontent, and national elections are next year. And there, I think you're going to see that the alternative for Deutschland and the Sarah Wagenknecht party cannot be ignored, that they are going to get the kind of votes necessary to empower them to play a role, if not a leading role, at least a participatory role in a ruling coalition. They cannot be ignored. And once that happens, Germany will have no choice but to change. I think, first of all the politicians today that are supporting the policies towards Ukraine, towards Russia, will be voted out. They will not be in power this time next year. Germany will have a new coalition that will have to yield to the will of the people, that will have to reflect the desire of the people. Germany economically can't sustain its support for Ukraine, and it can't exist without access to cheap Russian energy. These are two realities that are going to manifest themselves politically inside Germany in the national elections this year or next year.
If it goes in that direction, do you think how influential that would be for the European Union? Are they going to be able to influence other countries?
First of all, there is no European Union without Germany. Let's just be straight up. And so the European Union will be influenced by that. Germany, a German government that decides not to support Ukraine means the European Union stops supporting Ukraine because it's a consensus-driven organization, and Germany is not Hungary. It can't be bullied. It can't be pushed out. Also keep in mind that Macron himself is under a tremendous amount of political pressure right now, facing impeachment because he refused to empower the duly elected representatives of the French people, who elected people from different parties. They wanted to come together, presented their coalition government, and Macron said no. So now he's headed towards a constitutional challenge that may cost him his presidency, which means that's the end of Macron. England, even though it's our Great Britain, is not part of the European Union, still very influential power on the continent. It's facing tremendous amount of internal difficulties, budgetary, political, etc. Fact is, I don't think there's a country in Europe right now where there isn't some sort of stewing political crisis. The European Union is not healthy. It's fracturing as we speak. And a Germany that said we're going to change direction would be the end of European unity regarding Ukraine and Russia.